The Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, includes a target to reduce the level of illicit financial flows, which is an enormous success for the tax justice movement, and gives great hope of progress being made in the period to 2030. But at the moment, we still haven't seen the indicators for that target defined. And there's emerged a debate over the actual meaning of the word illicit, which is really just a cover for people trying to weaken significantly what that target can actually deliver. So I'm going to talk through the nature of the success in achieving that target within the Sustainable Development Goals, and then the nature of the backlash and some of the underlying issues, why it's important that we include multinational tax behaviour within that target, and what an appropriate indicator might look like to ensure the kind of accountabilities that we need particularly on different state actors. Whereas the Millennium Development Goals, which was the globally agreed goals governing our international development efforts from 2000 to 2015, were almost completely focused on very laudable social goals, with the implication that these would be in great part funded by aid, and certainly no emphasis on tax. The Sustainable Development Goals, which are the successor framework running from 2015 to 2030, really turn that on its head. The emphasis is very much on domestic policy, very much more open to issues like inequality, and very focused on the means of implementation, of which tax is identified as the primary means of implementation, as it should be. Now, in support of that, we have this target 16.4, a very important one, to significantly reduce illicit financial flows, and some other things. But that's the key piece. Now, illicit financial flows was a term popularized by Raymond Baker, an American businessman who saw during years of doing business in various African countries, saw the ways in which a whole set of businesses operating internationally manipulated their trade pricing in order to ensure that they didn't pay taxes in the countries where they were making money. Now, on that basis, he wrote a book which raised issues of tax justice in a way that was quite successful in the United States, and really raised this up the agenda. And he set up a small think tank organization called Global Financial Integrity, which continues to generate estimates of the overall scale of those illicit flows. The greater success, if you like, here is that we have for the first time a global agreement to challenge this phenomenon, to reduce the degree of corrupt flows of one sort and another, of multinational tax abuses and individual tax evasion, that particularly affect lower-income countries, but in fact affect all countries, not just causing great revenue losses, but also undermining governance in important ways. So this is a great success. It's also a success because it reflects a narrative shift away from a view that you perhaps could say the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, reflected, which is that development can be delivered by aid, but the obstacle is the corruption. And to make that a bit more blunt, that would be donor countries saying development can be delivered by our aid, but the obstacle is your corruption. Now, that's perhaps a little bit unfair, but it's not at all uncommon to have seen and heard that type of view expressed, particularly in the period around 2000 when the Millennium Development Goals were put together. Now, the narrative underpinning the Sustainable Development Goals feels very different. Obviously, it's much more, and particularly in Target 16.4, it's much closer to financial secrecy, particularly delivered by major financial centres and the host countries and multinational corporations, undermines development in a whole set of ways, including by facilitating various forms of corruption. And therefore, we need global solutions. We can't simply point the finger at some lower-income countries and say they're not dealing with the corruption problem. So a real step forward in that way, as well as in the substance of the target. Thirdly, this is a success, the establishment of this target, because it reflects very directly Southern and particularly African leadership. The high-level panel on illicit financial flows out of Africa, chaired by Thabo Mbeki, generated an enormous amount of policy interest and uptake, and really set the frame for the discussions within about the post-2015 framework that gave rise to this target. Now, that report was very clear that African countries had work to do themselves in terms of dealing with issues of corruption and transparency and accountability at home, but at the same time identifying the global issues that also needed to be addressed. And, you know, the report puts, of course, a great deal of emphasis on the role of multinational companies' tax behaviour, identifying that as a very important part of the problem. Now, we move into the period of the backlash. The target having been agreed, we find an increasing momentum around attempts to strip out that element, that perhaps most important element, addressing multinational tax behaviour from the target. And that's happening in a number of ways. Partly it's straightforward lobbying, arguing, for example, that the OECD's process, the Base Erosion and Profit Shifting Action Plan that ran from 2013 to 2015, has really dealt with the problem of multinational tax behaviour. Now, that's clearly not true, and none of the OECD countries themselves, never mind lower income countries who've been largely excluded from that process, believe that to be true. The European Union is actively considering adopting for tax within the European Union a complete break from the OECD's international rules. Meanwhile, the United States has been considering a range of changes to its corporate tax that are entirely at odds with what was discussed in the base erosion and profit shifting process. So there's no sense in which the OECD is seen to have dealt with this problem for OECD countries or for lower income countries. But this argument continues. It continues to be made that actually multinational tax issues shouldn't be addressed within this target. And that's being focused, the argument, around a particular argument, a particular claim that illicit, in the term illicit financial flows, actually means illegal, strictly illegal. Now, for that, people often go back to the definition put forward by Global Financial Integrity, that illicit financial flows are illegal movements of money or capital from one country to another. GFI classifies this movement as an illicit flow when the funds are illegally earned, transferred, and or utilised. Now, if you go back to Raymond Baker's book, in some sense you could think he's making the same argument. He talks about a small proportion of illicit flows being related to corruption, bribery, and the theft of state assets, a larger part being related to the proceeds of crime, and the most significant element being what he calls commercial tax evasion. But in fact, Raymond is talking there largely about trade pricing issues, which, if challenged, at least where they're taking place within a multinational, and he includes both related party and unrelated party issues, but at least where they're taking part in a multinational, then if challenged, there's a likelihood that they wouldn't necessarily be found to be evasion, but rather unlawful tax avoidance, which is, you know, an important third category, as Professor Saul Picciotto has pointed out in the conference here in Nairobi, we can't just think about illegal evasion and legal avoidance. In fact, there's a large area of unlawful tax avoidance where schemes, if challenged, may be found to be unlawful and therefore the tax benefits not to arise, but where you wouldn't expect to see prosecutions for criminality following. And so the GFI definition, it's slightly unclear whether there's a sort of misuse of the term illegal there, if the intention is to capture unlawful avoidance, or if in fact they've changed the position completely from Raymond's original book, not to look at multinational tax issues. And that's certainly what some people have claimed, although I don't think GFI necessarily hold that view. But the other view is that illicit simply doesn't mean illegal. And to begin with, we can just look to the definition. If we take the Oxford English Dictionary definition, for example, but others will do, illicit is defined on these lines as something forbidden by law, rules, or custom. Now, forbidden by law obviously meets the definition for illegality. Adding in things that are forbidden by rules or custom broadens the definition out to illicit. And in that sense, illicit is a wider category than illegal. In particular, it's going to pick up a broader set of tax behaviours that may be socially forbidden in some sense, but within the letter of the law, or at least not necessarily passing into criminality. But there's also a view, and this is another way in which illicit and illegal are importantly different, that some things can be defined as illegal by a state which is itself illegitimate, for example, a dictatorship, and therefore that the category of illicit can sometimes be smaller than the category of illegal, if the definition of illegal itself is not legitimate. And that's an argument made by Stephanie Blankenberg and Mushtaq Khan in the World Bank volume on illicit flows from 2012, edited by Peter Reuter, which has any number of good articles in it, incidentally. But in any case, it is clear both in practice and by definition that illicit does not mean illegal. Rather, illicit covers what is being hidden for legal and for social reasons. And in a sense, the key defining feature, therefore, of illicit financial flows is that they are hidden, rather than that they are necessarily, and in all cases, criminal. And in particular, this means that we absolutely include a large element of multinational tax behaviours that are broadly covered under the opacity of their accounting, and which are certainly having a broadly similar impact in terms of stripping out taxable profit from countries at all levels of income. Okay, if we think about the Mbeki panel report's definition of illicit financial flows as being the key political definition used by people discussing this as it was being considered as part of the Sustainable Development Goals, they follow a proposal I made actually and break it down into four areas: the laundering of the proceeds of crime and the abuse of power. So both in a sense the more traditional view of corruption, and then market and regulatory abuse. Now that's things like hiding ownership in order to establish a secret monopoly position, for example, and then tax abuse. Now, clearly, as we move down the vertical axis, we're moving towards issues of where the capital origin is not illegal. These are legitimately earned profits, but the transaction may well be illicit. That's to say, what they're doing is hiding something which would be forbidden, if not legally, then socially. And this is the area where historically, the international organisations and others have been much less comfortable. And that, again, as I say, is why it's a great success to have this made part of the Sustainable Development Goals framework. and certainly why anyone discussing that target before it was agreed would have been clear that it was in a context where multinational tax abuses were very much part of the intended scope. If we look then to the estimates of illicit financial flows to start thinking about scale and about the type of scale indicators that could perhaps be used to make the SDG target meaningful, we can think of four main areas. So perhaps the most famous area is the work done on trade mispricing, partly by Global Financial Integrity, but also by looking particularly at Africa, James Boyce and Leontine de Kumana, also by researchers at the UN Economic Commission for Africa. Now, the GFI and Boyce and de Kumana use national level data, so aggregated national level on trade, to look at the mismatches between what's being reported as exports on one side and as imports on the other. The difficulty with that is that it covers a lot of the detail of what's happening. So the UNECA staff used aggregated commodity level data to get slightly more granular results for what are going on, and probably results that you can be a little bit more confident in. The gold standard, if you like, is the work that Simon Pack and a few others have done using transaction level data, so they can actually identify the agents who are consistently involved in abnormally priced trades in order to shift capital illicitly. Unfortunately, that data tends to be very difficult to get access to, including for researchers, and so we don't have the kind of global analysis on that basis that we'd like, and the national level estimates remain, I think, with a quite high degree of uncertainty, and certainly have been criticised by a number of researchers as not being entirely reliable. Capital account measures, following from the work of Michael Dooley and others at the World Bank, also used by GFI and Boyce and de Kumana, are another part of the estimates we often hear spoken about, but again are subject to some degree of uncertainty on the scale, because the assumptions that you make about, in particular, whether you go beyond the net errors and omissions, the sort of the error term in the capital account, to consider other aspects or not, makes an enormous difference to the scale of estimated illicit flows. And ultimately, dealing just with an error term is somewhat unsatisfactory if we're not certain what sort of things are underneath that error, and if at least a certain amount of them may not be illicit flows necessarily. there's then two types of areas of work that more directly focus on the revenue losses, and therefore from a tax point of view are particularly interesting. One is the work on undeclared wealth. This is wealth held in held offshore, held simply in other jurisdictions and not being declared to the tax authorities at home. Now, James Henry, former chief economist at McKinsey, did a very striking piece of work for the Tax Justice Network called The Price of Offshore, estimating the total scale of that wealth between the range of $21 and $32 trillion, and giving rise to a revenue loss towards $200 billion annually. Gabriel Zucman, an economist who's worked with Thomas Piketty, did a very different estimate on a much narrower type of financial asset, finding that up to about $8 trillion was being held offshore in this way, but with a different calculation actually coming out again to a revenue loss of $190-$200 billion annually. Now, obviously, more work needs to be done on those estimates, and is in fact being done. They are being refined in different ways by different people, and we're moving towards being able, I think, to be a bit clearer about exactly which countries are bearing the losses and where the undeclared assets actually are. Now, the final element is the element I'm focusing on in this presentation. It's shifted profits. And here we have estimates by a number of pieces of work from the Tax Justice Network, particularly by myself working with Petr Jansky from the Charles University in Prague, but also estimates from the OECD, from UNCTAD, and from researchers at the International Monetary Fund. Now, those researchers, Crivelli and Demoisen and Keane, have created a methodology which is probably the strongest we have right now. And on that basis, they estimate revenue losses of $600, $650 billion annually due to the shifting of multinationals' profits away from the countries where they actually arise, where the economic activity actually takes place. Now, Petr Jansky and I have revisited that using what we think is better data, but applying the same methodology, and we find, we really confirm the methodology seems reasonably robust, although there's a couple of areas where we'd like to strengthen it in future. A slightly more conservative estimate of around $500 billion of revenue losses annually. And I'll talk a bit about the distribution of them. Now, obviously, if we look in simply in dollar terms at where the losses are taking place, almost inevitably they're largely concentrated in the biggest economies. So the United States stands out, but followed by with around $190 billion of revenue losses annually, followed by China, Japan, India, all between $40 and $70 billion. Argentina, France, Germany, all $15 to $20 billion a year. Pakistan, Indonesia, the Philippines, between $5 and $10 billion a year, just to give you some flavour of that. But if you want to understand the type of damage this is actually doing to a country, we need to compare it, not think in dollar terms, but compare those losses to their actual current tax revenues, their tax take. And here we see it's low-income countries overwhelmingly who are the most badly affected. Chad stands out as apparently suffering tax losses in excess of its current tax take, though that's partly because its current tax take is so low, it's largely reliant on natural resource revenues, and not necessarily so much of them either. But then we see a string of countries with revenue losses that are in the region of 20 to 40% of their current tax take, including Uganda, Pakistan, Ethiopia, and then another group where the losses are between 10 and 20%, Gambia, Kenya, Senegal, Malawi, and others. So these are clearly, to the extent that we can rely on these estimates, these are very substantial losses from one form of tax loss only, accounting for between 10 and 100% of total tax take. So the potential to really increase very substantially the resources available for investment in public services like health and education. So who wins? Who's coming out on the good side of this, if you like? Who is it that's attracting all of the profit that multinationals are taking from elsewhere and getting a small cut of that? Now, for that, the IMF methodology isn't terribly reliable because it relies on statutory rates. And we know from our research on US multinationals, where the data's a bit better, that actually the effective rates in the places that attract most profit shifting are nowhere near their statutory rates. And so in particular, we find five, six jurisdictions that attract the vast majority of profit shifting from US multinationals, from which pretty much every other country suffers. And all of them have an effective tax rate of just a few percent, often between 0 and 1 or 2%. That's Bermuda, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, which is particularly big, Ireland, Switzerland, to a slightly lesser extent, Singapore and the Cayman Islands. Now really, it's important for us to understand that this is a problem that goes two ways, and to track and eventually to be able to reduce this important element of illicit financial flows, we need to understand both sides of this. We need to track countries' progress in reducing the losses that they're suffering, but also track what's happening to the countries that are benefiting, whether they continue, as the ones I've mentioned do, to have as much as 80 or 90% of their declared profits, in fact, relating to economic activity that takes place elsewhere, in other words, being shifted in, or if that's reducing over time. We need to know who these countries are on a consistent basis in order to be able to challenge their role in that behaviour. So, the proposal that we are now considering to put forward for to be one of the indicators for Target 16.4 of the Sustainable Development Goals really aims to push those accountabilities. Now, we start from the point that there is a broad global consensus, both among G77 countries who are increasingly identifying the problem in this area, but also expressed through the G20 and OECD base erosion and profit shifting process, which identified a single goal in respect of multinationals' tax abuses. And that goal is, and I quote, to reduce the misalignment between the real economic activity of multinationals and where their profits are declared for tax purposes. So that, as a target, is uncontroversial and fits very clearly into the intended definition of the illicit financial flows target. Now, the base erosion and profit shifting process, although, as I say, it's largely seen not to have reduced the problem of the tax abuses themselves in any very dramatic way, it did come up with this goal, and that's very useful. And it did one other thing, which is it created an OECD standard for what's called country-by-country reporting by multinationals. Now, that means that multinationals over a certain size have to report, at least to their home tax authority, a set of variables reflecting on a country-by-country basis where their economic activity takes place, their sales, their employment in particular, where their profits are being declared and how much tax is being paid, again, in each country. Now, that data, actually, that's the OECD standard draws very closely on the original TJN proposal of 2003, put forward by Professor Richard Murphy, for an international accounting standard to require country-by-country reporting. That data, if made available, made public, as the Tax Justice Network intention has always been, would in fact give you the information that you need to construct an indicator in the Sustainable Development Goals that would exactly give you the accountabilities that you need. So our proposal is that we use that country-by-country reporting to track for each country the misalignment ratio, that's to say, or perhaps a few variations, so a few different ratios, the extent to which their profit is in line or not with their share of economic activity. And by doing that, what we'll see is both the countries that are losing and how much they're losing and whether they're able to reduce that over time. So are we succeeding in terms of the target? But also we'll see which countries are winning and are they being challenged also to reduce the distortion that they're creating over time. So a single indicator potentially which gives you accountabilities at both ends of multinationals' profit shifting. In conclusion, three points really. First, it's clear, you know, the evidence we have, it's probably the most robust evidence we have in respect of illicit financial flows. Multinational tax abuses disproportionately damage development in lower income countries. And so this absolutely should be a priority within this target and the target itself within the broader Sustainable Development Goals. Secondly, this question of illicit or illegal has been used, is being used, in an attempt to subvert the global agreement that was made to fight illicit financial flows and to subvert the African leadership behind that agreement by introducing a systematic bias against tackling multinational tax abuses. And I want to add one more point there. If we go with a line that says it's only about what's illegal, that's not neutral and objective. Imagine two different countries, one high income, one low income, that have exactly the same tax law in place. But the high income country has higher administrative capacity and a stronger tax authority, a stronger judicial system. the same abusive tax behaviour by a multinational in the high-income country is systematically much more likely to be challenged and to be found illegal than it is in the low-income country. Now that means if we insist on a definition that only captures illegality, first of all, we're going to miss a lot of multinational tax abuses that never rise to the point of illegality or are never challenged and found to be illegal, which is a different issue. Secondly, we're going to introduce a systematic bias against identifying this behaviour in exactly those countries where we know it is disproportionately most important, that's to say in lower income countries. So the only reason that we could go down this road is if we really wanted to take multinationals out entirely, and we were so convinced of the importance of doing that that we didn't care about the damage it would do to lower income countries. We should resist this absolutely. Because the measurement of multinationals' tax abuse is, I think, with country-by-country reporting, probably the most robust of all illicit flow indicators of scale. In fact, perhaps that's true even without country-by-country reporting, and once we have that data, in fact, that will improve the position still further. It's the best shot we have at actually having a good target with accountability in the right places in target 16.4 of the Sustainable Development Goals. And so we should do everything possible to ensure that this remains within the Sustainable Development Goals target and that there are strong indicators of the sort that we're now putting forward. Thank you very much.